peaks, and the second year it completely and totally bombed. So why bother? Why bother doing anything interesting? Let's just give them all the crap that they want to see, that we want to show, in any case, that, you know, requires the mentality of a basically a piece of wood in order to watch it.
Get the log.
We'll go ahead and give them more of that, because obviously it's a failure, and they'll just point to the Lynch experience as like, well, we gave it a shot, folks, but we know what you really want to hear.
Okay, now
we'll
listen.
Give it to you.
Yeah, it's a point that comes to mind is that we can have room for optimism because the homeopathic effect of Mike and I in the church here is proven, because you've got a TV series that everybody was involved in the spring that was about me, all right? And
right.
Now that never could have been done before. So that shows you the evolution of the solar government exposure I'm putting into this, and that I will be acknowledged and Bob Rule will come, because this was the joke that Lynch realized. That
well, it's either homeopathic or some kind of Bach flower essence, you know, because it's working on more of an emotional level than a healing level, I think.
Yeah, well, now that's I think that maybe that's why they wanted to use Lynch in the first case, was to create some paranoia leading up to the wonderful autumn season we have in the mixed corporate media solar theater we have here, with paranoia running amok everywhere, eh?
Exactly. Anyways, another point was I think Hawk had some has some psychic abilities in the show.
Oh, yeah, that's the other point. That he, I sort of said that Cooper liked Twin Peaks and the Natural Point. That's right. As I was trying to remember, Hawk represents the old nature, the Captain.
Sure, he's
Kiefer.
A physical embodiment of that. Somehow he's a sort of a native figure, I guess you could say.
Oh, that he certainly is. And so he represents the original psychic behavior we had before visual space took us over.
Exactly.
And so Cooper is really impressed with Hawk. And you notice occasionally at key points in the series when we fly over the wood, that either is a hawk or an owl, you know, you're flying, you're a bird.
Mm-hmm.
So he doesn't like birds, yet he's hypnotized by a hawk, right?
Well, he doesn't like birds. I think he doesn't like birds in the sense, you know, the same thing as the robin biting the worm at the end of Blue Velvet. I really don't think that Cooper likes the juxtaposition of those two images, because it points out a schism in his own sort of self.
That's right. And now the proof of the psychicness, the psychic theme, is that Cooper's ideal image of his back-to-nature self is Tibet. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And so what does he want when he's lying there after he's shot?
He wants to make love to a woman that he has true affection for.
Yeah, which is, what would we call that? That is the private citadel of consciousness desire, right? That's the soul desire of every point, every person of consciousness. You know what I mean? Every element of consciousness, right? That's the raw private citadel. And then
he's kind of coming to some sort of union, in a sense.
Yeah, and then on the more public level, he wants to crack the Lindbergh case.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. He also wants to crack the JFK Monroe connection, illustrated in the earlier series. See, there's the JFK metaphor, which is illustrated in the movie Wild at Heart, which deals with the summer event of the murder of Ricky White's father. I don't know if you know about that, the guy who had the JFK diary.
No.
All right. Anyways, that was something we talked about in the last show. And what else did he want? He wants the
Tibetans. Did he want to go to Tibet?
No, he wants the Tibetans to get their country back.
Oh, right.
And so that's his political agenda. Meanwhile, what is Albert Rosenfield about? Is he the cyberpunk?
I think he's Joe Friday in disguise.
Yeah, he's the numbness of the cyberpunk.
In a sense, yeah. Well, I mean, on one level, I think that he's just stuck there as a foil. As a foil for someone, for Cooper to play off of, so you can get a better sense of who Cooper is, because it can't just be him talking to his tape recorder the whole time, so just on the straight.
Okay, how about this? He also represents that in terms of a Jungian analysis of a dream, that when you have a dream, all the characters are parts of yourself. If this is Cooper's dream, this whole show, and Lynch's dream, and, oh yeah, the other psychic character is the little kid that looked like Dave Lynch.
Well, it was his son.
That was actually his son?
Yeah, it said so on the credits.
Okay, is Jennifer Lynch his daughter?
Yes.
Okay, yeah, she wrote the diary.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, yeah, some people were confused about whether that was Lynch shrunk down or his son, but that is his son. Now, he's psychic, and he's the magician. You see, it really is a tiny theme that this series is about. I mean, it's there now, it's obvious. What were we just saying, okay, about Albert? He being a part of the effects of Cooper, he represents the guy who is, he's in the interval of Cooper, who can't make a decision whether he wants to go into the techno future or the natural past.
Exactly.
You know what
it's
I mean?
Part of himself that he is kind of rejecting, but he just wants to live there He just wants to be in Twin Peaks all the time.
Yeah, which he can't be. And so he partly knows that. Now, what Albert represents is that part of his private little conscience looking at himself doing all these things in a stiff thing. And Cooper's dream is to have that encounter with a person that he's affectionate for, which Albert apparently would not be able to have. Right?
Mm-hmm.
So the disservice of Cooper's modern-day detachment, his discarnate state of looking at all these modalities and he doesn't know where to identify with, is expressed most extremely by Albert.
Exactly.
I'll tell you some interesting thing. We do a lot of with the number 22. And have you read Laura Palmer's diary? Have you seen it?
No, it's in hardback. Too much money.
Oh, no, paperback at the at the world's biggest bookstore.
Oh, okay.
I've
never
seen it in hardback. But,
I'm on my way.
Yeah, and the point is that she was born on July 22nd, 1972.
Oh, praise Bob.
Yeah, you know about the 22 stuff?
Yeah.
Okay, now the point is on July 22nd, in 1972, the Holy Office, our Holy Office here, Mae Brussel, that was when she got involved on that day with Paul Krasner and John Lennon and Yoko Ono to get the money to publish the first realist dealing with Mae Brussel's material, that upstage Woodward and Bernstein, on that day, July 22nd, 1972. And you know what else happened on that day? The Mae Brussel's the top-down analyst. The bottom-up analyst, Marshall McLuhan. His book, which deals with the conspiracy called Take Today, The Executive is Dropout, was released on July 22nd, 1972. Now, of course, Lynch probably doesn't know this, but he's talking about our church and our important dates.
It's not important that he knows it.
That's right. That's right. He's channeling.
That's right.
And so there's the next metaphor, is that he is dealing with his own scenario, yet it strikes a chord. He knows at a certain level that he's echoing what the concerns of Americans are going into the 90s, but he doesn't know that the answer is here in the form of a double-duty interrobang here on CKLN.
And also it doesn't really matter, all the hype and all that kind of stuff, because in a sense, no matter how many people get touched by Bob, in whatever level, it still hits. You know, I mean, it doesn't matter if a lot of people don't understand what's really going on. I mean, it doesn't really matter if they're just going to try and figure out who did Laura Palmer in, and that's all they care about, really. All they care about is plot. That doesn't matter, because all of that is kind of hitting them on a psychic, all of the real message is hitting them on a psychic level anyways.
That's right, and cliche awareness is the most avant-garde state today, and it's advisable that people remain unaware today, considering the fire we're walking in, all right? Now, I want to tell you the final clincher, Mike, that proves this is about Bob, is one of Bob's best jokes. One of my greatest hits a couple of years ago was when I pointed out the movie They Live. Did you ever see that movie?
No.
By, what's his name, Carpenter, Mike? John Carpenter, was he the director? Excellent movie, and in it, the character sees the Orwellian nightmare that the planet Earth is in by putting on sunglasses.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Now, the week that came out, and it was pulled pretty quickly down here at Eaton's, but a lot of subgeniuses saw it. The week that it came out, Roy Orbison died. Okay, now he was notorious for being the first pop singer, maybe.
To
wear sunglasses. Now, this is a great Bob joke. Many people understood Bob's pattern recognition for the first time when they saw how Bob could connect popular culture events with political conspiracies. Well, what happens here in the premiere of the second series? Donna
put sunglasses on.
And they change. And it's Laura's sunglasses. So Laura went through the They Live experience a few years ago, and that's what happened to her. She got involved with Bob. Isn't that amazing?
That is simply amazing.
Yeah, and I think that David Lynch knows that, and that's a little joke to his friend John Carpenter.
I think a lot of it is a little joke.
Yeah, among filmmakers, that's right.
Exactly.
I mean, I've asked Mike to give me some references to other films. Apparently there are, but I haven't heard anybody give me the quotes that he's actually referring to in previous 40s movies or whatever.
I think if you look more closely, there's a lot of that. There was an awful lot of that, obviously, in Wild at Heart.
Yeah, that's true. That was almost too obvious.
Yeah.
That may be... why was it so obvious there? I think that movie failed compared to Blue Velvet.
Well, it just wasn't very subtle, that's all.
Yeah, why would... maybe what? What was he trying to get rid of the subtlety he was dealing with in Twin Peaks, so he went the other end?
I think at some level it's just kind of... you've got to wonder about Lynch, you know? If he's really... If time management and financial aspects didn't somehow overwhelm the entire, you know, process of putting down what he wanted to put down.
In Wild at Heart.
I'd say so, because it had me going for the first two-thirds, but then all of a sudden,
yeah. Yeah.
You know, it was like, okay, let's get this over with.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so I'll tell you an amazing theme that's going on and how major art forms echo what's going on here at CKLN. You juxtapose Wild at Heart with the new movie Goodfellas. Have you seen that?
No.
Okay, well, Wild at Heart is about, of course, me and Connie in our early days and then recent paranoid situations we were in. But the
New Mexico, perhaps?
Oh, yeah. You know about that?
Oh, of course.
Do I know you?
No. No, I know Connie.
Oh, okay. You work with, you are, you help by Connie.
I'm helped by Connie, yeah.
Are you, you got a birthday tomorrow?
No, no. Oh,
okay.
I'm a master of hyperslack, though.
Okay. That's...
Which is actually kind of interesting because there's an awful lot of hyperslack in Twin Peaks as well. I mean, certainly when Cooper does say that what you need to do is give yourself a present every day, a little surprise, not to plan it, but
let
it happen spontaneously.
Yeah.
I mean, I just looked at that and said, well, you know what?
Even Major, the UFO guy, the Major has slack. His aphorisms are very profound. Remember, he said he liked his medals because they were their own achievement.
And that's
that
right.
Pride got in the way.
Pride gets in the way.
I've never heard that said before. That's almost as good as our slogan last show, which was, do whatever you want as long as it hurts somebody.
Yeah.
Are you the guy who teaches school in Toronto?
Something like that, yeah.
Hey, Mike, this is the guy who overhears kids in his high school saying they heard Bob last night, and he listens to them, eavesdrops on them talking about Bob, and they would never suspect their teacher was joining in.
But there is Bob papered all over my walls.
Yeah, the pink Bob.
No, the real Bob.
Where can we get some of that?
Well, it's he's papered all over my wall. That's all I can say right now.
Okay, well...
There's Bob staring out the window of my room every day.
Okay, now the point about Goodfellas is that that's not about me and Connie. That's about my evil twin brother, Dick Dobbs.
Oh, yes.
And his wife, Karen. Not Carolyn, Karen.
Right.
And so check out Goodfellas. You'll see the sorry pink state that my brother Dick has gotten into in the last couple of years under the witness protection program since I moved into control of the tetratic process on March 88.
There might be some reference in that in the Three-Fisted Tales as well.
Oh, yeah, yeah. See, the Three-Fisted Tales, if you read the Ivan Stang story,
right.
Yeah, that's the that's a pretty accurate description of my and Connie's life. Through all time.
Yeah.
I'd recommend that story. And John Shirley's story is good, too.
Yeah.
John Shirley, I think Mike is interviewed in a new Mondo 2000 magazine, or in a recent issue, anyways. He's a good joint writer. I don't know, man. Donna's younger sister reads a poem about Laura and says, the woods make her sad, but the dance makes her glad. See, the woods is the electric wood and the old wood, all right?
Uh-huh.
You remember the theme of the Bookhouse Boys? Look at that, the Bookhouse.
Bookhouse,
visual
right.
Space. Is that there's something in the woods that perverts everybody, you know, going back eons, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the woods make her sad. That's the old space. And then the new electric space is a dance. So the dance makes her glad. So the problem with Laura and her drug addiction is she's electric. She, and like your students here in Toronto, are addicted to the electric fire.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the problem we've got. And they will just disincarnate. No, I won't say that's a wrong word. They will sabotage their physical body, as illustrated by the suicidal desires of Laura.
Mm-hmm.
See, this is the effort to get rid of the old body percept to deal with the new fire, the new electric body percept.
The dance makes her glad. She's fire walking.
Yeah, she can. Well, that gives her a merging with the real impulse, the real nature that motivates her now, which is the electric nature. You see, you can't go back to the past nature because you're really being conditioned by the new nature. So we're left to sort of merge with the new nature, unless we have perspective or Bob.
Well, and we have Bob.
We do.
We sure do.
So I know you've been waiting to call for a couple of years, and you picked the right night.
Well, yeah, and I'm sure that I'll hear about it tomorrow.
Oh, one more thing. Yeah, you will. About the midget. Mike, this is for you. The midget, you agree with me that the midget is walking the dance, the fire walk, right? In Cooper's dream in the beginning, you know, when he sees the antimatter Laura. And you know that scene where the midget walks?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, that is parodied by Andy when he gets hit on the head. You know, the board.
Well, that's interesting, yeah.
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 And so he does a satire on the fire dance, the fire walk that the midget did, and which is we're going to see Bob do it in the denouement, right? We're going to see how Bob does the fire walk. That's what's coming up. Okay, the owl is not what it seems.
The boy has a
The owl is wisdom, obviously, right? So we're talking about different kinds of wisdom here, the old nature wisdom, the new nature wisdom, the interval wisdom. So that's why Bob, the anti-Bob, would have a aspect of the owl factor, because this guy is obviously a capable person, quite detached from physical concerns.
Definitely. I mean, it was non-physical so far.
Yeah, and especially if Leland Palmer knew him 40 years ago. I mean, how old is this guy?
Well, his hair turned white.
That's right. I think Palmer, do you think Palmer shot Cooper?
Yes.
Yeah, because if you look back, you'll see that the gloves that he wore when he...
Exactly. Same glove.
Yeah, and the same glove that knocked...
Dr. Jacoby.
Okay, man. Okay, Jack, thanks for the call.
Okay. Have a good evening, Bob.
Thank you. So, Mike, I got it up too loud, eh?
Okay. Yes, a little too loud.
I'm sorry, Mike, to be going on, but it has to be done.
Well, it's okay. You just seem to be going on a lot tonight. We've missed a few phone calls and, you know.
Any more?
Yeah, there is, actually. I don't know. You just... Yeah, so, you are talking it tonight.
About Twin Peaks, because I think it's exciting that I said 2 months ago that the dream in... if you see the phone, just stop me. I mean, I'll...
Well, the phone's been... It's been on hold for the last 20 minutes, so...
Well, is there someone there now?
Yeah, we've had callers waiting all night,
Bob.
So let's stop talking so much.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, I'm with you on this.
Okay, thank you.
Hello?
Hi.
Hi, Mike.
Hi. Oh, hi, Edward.
Hi. You'll be happy to hear I want to talk about the Twin Peaks.
What a surprise.
No, actually, two aspects of it, which are, I think, somewhat secondary. One was...
Ed, would you agree with much of what our previous caller said?
I was blabbing with Kent in the back room there.
He didn't listen. Okay. All right, what's your points?
Anti-Bob. Oh, boy, I have to listen to this tomorrow.
On a tape, yeah.
Okay, there was two things. One was how we perceive the media, medium of television. I'll get that out of the way first. I think it's a secondary one, and that is network viewership's down to 61%, supposedly. Like, whereas once, all TV watchers were tuned into the networks. As recently as the early 80s, it was 98% or something of all viewers would be tuned into the networks. So this cultishness of Twin Peaks is now the norm for TV. I mean, there were some great Saturday night shows, Hockey Night in Canada, Sid Caesar, Jackie Gleason, Saturday Night Live, but they were, you know, they're mass generic products of the last 30 years of TV. So this cultishness, Kent and I just jammed a way to watch Twin Peaks next summer on Toronto Island. We'll have a Twin Peaks picnic. And everyone will come, will bring their chapter they've taped. Some will have the commercials on, some have taken the commercials off. And we'll get a couple of long extension cords going to two separate trees on the island. And we can start the Twin Peaks anytime, you know. The early people can get there and watch the first chapter, and they'll watch the second chapter, and the latecomers, they can go over to the other TV and they'll watch the first chapter and the second chapter. And I was saying to Kent, I'll hear a female voice say, "What? You're watching TV under a tree on a day like this?" Well, she goes off and plays Frisbee with the other people who don't want to watch TV under a tree. This is an interesting mutation of how to watch network television, don't you think?
No.
It
doesn't sound very exciting, but Kent just walked in. Maybe he could support you, Edward.
Oh, I do support him. I think this will be a blast.
Yeah.
Okay, well, you guys look after that, eh?
Twin Peaks picnic next July 22nd.
That would be the, why don't you make it 1992 and have the 20th anniversary of Laura's death? Laura's birth.
Yeah, we could do that.
Make it 2 years, and I may have time in 1992 to join in, because I've got such a busy year over the next 20 months, at least 12 months, with affairs in Washington. I can't really, it doesn't appeal to me at this point, probably because I can't put my energy into it.
You have to bear with some of your followers, disciples, whatever we are, Bob, because you know, we're not as dematerialized as you, and sometimes we have to go and do bodily things, you know, like take out the garbage and go to picnics and stuff, you know.
Well, okay, I'll make a donation to it then. Yeah. I can probably get the foundation, the Doctors for Bob Institute, to make a donation to it for funding, because the Ontario government's not going to give any money for that. And don't let Stang take advantage of it as a revival, okay? There's no way, even though Mike used to like to have Stang up here. He wanted to have Stang up here for a revival, but I don't think Mike is into that anymore. What do you think, Mike? No, Mike says no, he wouldn't want to do that. So, yeah, no problem. As long as you don't bring Stang in, go ahead with it.
Now, one other thing, Bob, about your what can we call it, a fluid state? I mean, you are a woman. You are,
I'm a murderer. I'm a male. I'm an insect. I'm every aspect of the human dimension is art form.
Okay.
That's the content, right?
Okay. Now, the female energy that you manifest.
Yeah.
See, I have a little trace of that. I went steady with a feminist for about 5 years. No, that's hard to do, to go steady with a girlfriend who was a feminist. So I'll always be, part of my consciousness will be, I will be a radical feminist in part, you know, for the rest of my life.
Yeah.
And I'm partly grateful to her for that. But so looking at David Lynch from that point of view, which I think, you know, there was some radical feminist looking at, say, something like Hitchcock, woman as victim. You know, you do that if you're filmmakers in Silent Days for two reasons. One, you make the women in the audience nervous because they identify with the woman as victim. And also you pull some chords to the men in the audience. All men want to be heroes and save the women and children first.
Yeah.
So that's just a given component of film and a lot of television. Fiction. But with Lynch, there's some funny mixture of transcendence and repugnance about female energy. The birds in Blue Velvet were first introduced to the audience. It was Laura Dern shyly confessing a private dream. I think it was about robins as a harbinger of bliss.
Yeah, can you hear me, Ed?
Yeah.
Am I coming through clear?
Yeah, fine.
I just didn't know the sensitivity. Yeah, that's a very good point. I forgot that. The robin metaphor, yeah.
And then at the end, with a plastic forced happy ending, a robin came in, was a harbinger of happiness, happy ending. Laura Dern's face was just so radiant. And Kyle MacLachlan, what was his name in that film, was in Blue Velvet? Well, he was the pre-Dale, okay, in that film. They look at the robin on the suburban kitchen windowsill, and it looks so beautiful. And the light was very Spielbergian, very fake. And the bird was fake. It looked like a wind-up bird you could buy in Spadina in Chinatown.
Yeah.
So here was, when Lynch first chose birds as a metaphor for some kind of transcending of the evil that had gripped this small town. And then at the end, It was a pretty fake bird. You know, it wasn't as good as hearing about the girl's dream in a convertible.
Yeah, well, in Wild at Heart, the Laura Dern character talks to Nicolas Cage about how his bird talks to him, his penis.
Oh.
Okay, now look at the metaphor on penis, and remember, Bob is a discarnate penis rubbed all the time in a state of ecstasy, you know, because of the tactile rub I'm getting, right, constantly. Think of the bird as a sexual organ, and then how it gravitates between transcendent source to wooden source.
Transcendent source to wooden source.
The dildo. You know, in Arizona, they have a new law now that you cannot have more than 5 dildos in your home. That is an actual legislated law in Arizona.
I won't ask how that came about. It must have been fun to in committee in the Arizona legislature to be discussing that one anyway.
I hope that Lynch is not falling into the Jungian trap of the anima and the animus. You know about that.
Yeah.
The feminine and the masculine, which William Irwin Thompson, to counter LaRouche, runs amok with, and LaRouche takes the other end and makes sure none of that Jungian stuff gets less than a satanic mythology, right? So you got that dialectic. I'm hoping Lynch is not a Jungian, but I think probably why you can't put your eyes on the borderline here is because it's not Jungian. belonging, and he's showing the discarded effect that we are not male or female anymore, and therefore you have this blurring of intimacies and tendencies in the characters.
The time-honored exercise. Blurring of tendencies. Yeah, because Henry the Eraserhead came to mind. He looked across the room in that film, and he saw a dog suckling little baby dogs, a mother dog, and he knew somewhere inside, and the audience knew it was coming, that his girlfriend was pregnant. You know, remember that anxiety about pregnancy in the first film? And that's another thing about nobody points out that it's a coincidence except the viewer. That's one other thing about the psychic theme of a lot of what you were talking about, was that, you know, characters have different degrees of psychic ability, but it's kind of inspiring that we in the audience, we feel psychic. We knew Dale Cooper was going to get shot. We just knew it from the third last commercial.
A good point. Now, here's the psychic thing is the feminine energy. We'll call it right hemisphere. Traditionally, under matriarchal conditions, people were psychic, okay? And they did it for survival, too. Yeah. They had to know what was over the horizon. Now, you take this psychic theme, which is the feminine. Now, the feminine gets slayed in this series. The fire gets slayed by the new fire, the electric fire. So the owl, if you think of the owl as a figure of wisdom, you can take the feminine wisdom. And the owl is not what it seems. I see this is where Lynch is going beyond the Jungian dialectic, is that the feminine itself, which is the electric discarnate state, the fire, which we are all induced and seduced by, is being slaughtered, because the new situation of discarnate man is discarnate being is a state of post psychicness, a state of making, where there's it's a hard situation under our autonomous situation to match with anything, and psychic matching. Matching on the psychic level is the last gasp of matching, is to have a psychic synchronicity, right?
The last gasp of matching?
Yeah, it's a psychic, it's a grasping and using the most deepest instincts to match with someone else and match your reality with them through the various psychic abilities. That is the last gasp of matching. And that's why psychic behavior is a 19th century phenomenon, if you think of the 19th century as a visually biased matching environment. We are beyond the psychic situation. And then the metaphor there of Twin Peaks is another element of the perfect pitch resonance that Lynch is consciously or unconsciously, as Jack pointed out, not important. He is showing the post-electric situation we're in of the search for human scale. And Twin Peaks comes back as a, not a search for roots, but is hiked up as a model for the desire, the anticipation of community again.
There's such an apocalyptic mood these days, Bob. So when you say last gasp of matching, I get an overwhelming feeling of, you know, 5 billion non-communicating humans on a Tower of Babel.
Yeah, but the good news is that we are you electrically fused. We are merged into that erogenous electronic discarnate zone. So this diversity, this confusion, this babble is now acceptable. That's why the cliche becomes archetype. Something that Jack said earlier about the normal is just as insightful. That's why Lynch doesn't have to know what he's doing. You can probe. I mean, Mike doesn't know what he's doing on this show. I do know, but I have to pretend I don't know. But we can create magic anyways. So ordinary awareness is the source of inspiration more than the high-intensity, Tim Leary's evolved consciousness. What was that phrase in the 60s, expand your consciousness? You know, that kind of scenario is not relevant to the electronic blast. It serves as an ersatz or fake anti-environment, and expanding your consciousness will come back as a temporary mood need, but it'll be balanced off the need for ordinariness. This is where Alan Watts comes in, right? He celebrated the ordinary awareness.
The lower jaw.
Did you concur with that, or?
No, I think that's just an effect of the electric environment. Oh. I think that the superior form of awareness is possible, but is not in any recognized tradition. That's why I have a monopoly on the situation. It's hard to explain this sense of detachment and involvement, which is not expressed by either of those words.
Mike,
the interval. All right, this interval state that I'm in.
papers,
the,
you know?
The slack state is what is necessary to survive today. And you're talking about the apocalypse that is the dominant mood today. You can see that the Tetra managers would hoik up Lynch in 1990, whether they put him in dead air or not. They're hoiking him up because he's dealing with the last gasp of matching, which is the apocalyptic scenario. That's the Antichrist, you know, the false prophets.
Yeah,
all that resonates, the Satanism, the concern with what Jesus said don't get involved in with, which was the psychic, right?
Yeah.
So the Antichrist would wake that up, and especially with the UFO scenario, the saviors. So I can see why Lynch would resonate with the concerns right now. I see it's all pre-programmed to have Lynch be successful in 1990 because it was pre-programmed to have what's happening in the fall around the world, you know, the collapse of this and that government and war-like situations, all nostalgic retrievals of the new of a new environment happening right now. Because if you put Bob on the air and present him as an anti-Bob, as a violent Bob, then
this is the day
you can keep the game going for another 22 months, let's say.
22 months.
Yeah, what would that be from now? That'd be 2 years. That'd be the fall of 1992, right?
Yeah, so what's getting into the presidential election?
Yeah, August 92. Ooh, that'll be a powerful time for me because that'll be the last gasp of the anti-Bob energies.
Oh. So you don't think the picnic on July 22nd, 92 is... Well...
Okay, I said I might be able to make that one. I don't think I can make the 91.
You're going to overcome it if
you... I can't make the 91. I'll be in the middle of the fire.
In this country, right?
How many times? Okay, and I think Jerry once mentioned 1992, Bob? 1992, Bob? He yelled at the end of a show. I think it was the July 11th show. Time zones. Okay.
I'm full.
Thanks, Ed.
Good night. Where does that come from?
We'd have to get the archives to check this out.
Mike, where do you get this stuff, this background Bob stuff? Is this George again?
It's the archives.
Okay.
So two callers in the span of
an hour and a half.
90 minutes, a slow show, but informative, as always.
Yeah, necessary, because we're miming the seminar going on right now. Did you notice the Moscow agent walked into Hussein's parlor earlier this week, maybe the end of last week? Now, this is real interesting. He came with a proposal and softened up into Moscow-Baghdad relations. I think we can look to that Moscow agent as going to worm around in Hussein's parlor. And you just might see Hussein being offed in the next couple of weeks.
Hmm.
You know what I mean? Because he came with a Trojan horse. He was beaming rather evil-like, looking like Dick Dobbs. And Hussein was just glad to have anybody come into his parlor from outside his country. So let's watch for that. Next caller?
Yeah, we should just... say we've got 30 minutes left. This is the Church of the Subjugious Radio Show. You're listening to CKLN. 88.1 in Toronto. Do you want a wet towel or anything? Or do you want to just...
Not like, this is not like 2 weeks ago. See, that show was a fast-paced, excellent, high-tech show. This is the afterimage, a contemplative show.
Well, we're going to keep going here. My name is Michael Dyer. Across from me is J.R. Bob Dobbs. This is the real Church of the Subgenius, for those who have been asking.
And remember, we'll be frenetic next week.
Yeah,
so.
And next week, fundraising. So
we're right on time. We're supposed to be the mood we are tonight.
Yeah.
This is the mood.
So we'll flip into our hyper.
Well, we call the spirit of that first guest on our show, wherever he was, whoever that guy was.
But big week next week, and we hope you'll all listen and come down during fundraising to CK Allen. So let's go to another call. Hello.
Hello, Bob.
Oh, is that Sean?
Yeah, it is.
Oh, my God. He's back from Germany. Oh, my Bob. Sorry. You went to Berlin, didn't you?
Yeah, I was in Berlin.
So you missed the Exodus press conference?
Yeah, I missed all that.
Well, you can buy it all next week.
Yeah, I'll buy it.
Fundraising, yeah. Yeah, we've been calling out for you, Sean.
Have you?
Yeah, we've been
I just got back on Monday.
Yeah, you were away all summer, and then I called you a couple of weeks ago, and you had gone to Germany.
Yeah.
So you prophesied that in your own New Year's Eve firewalk dance last New Year's Eve. You built a wall and knocked it over, right?
Yeah, I said I'd be there for it.
So what happened? What do you make of it?
What happened on the Berlin party?
What happened to you? What do you got to tell us?
Oh, man. It's been a long time. It's been 4 months. Jeez. I could tell you a lot of stuff, I guess. Yeah, I went to the party. It was pretty cool.
Oh, yeah. When was that? October 3rd?
Yeah, October 2nd, actually, was when stuff was going on.
Well, you know, you were celebrating with LaRouche because LaRouche got the notice on October 1st that the government backs down on all the charges it threw at him. They decided that they won't appeal the two judges' decision to say that LaRouche was framed and based up on fraudulent charges. Now, they got that notice on October 1st, and I asked them, did you guys party? And they said, no, we partied on October 3rd to celebrate the unification of Germany. Does this confirm that LaRouche is a Nazi agent, a Fourth Reich agent? Well, you partied with him. You were over there.
Yeah, well.
What happened?
A lot of people. They dropped a car. Did you ever see that thing in the news over here?
No.
They had this, I guess it was sort of an art exhibit of some sort, where they had a car raised up on a crane, and it was like an East German car, and people were shooting fireworks at it all night, and it was hung over a piece of the Berlin Wall that was still left over. And they kept it up there until about 12:30 or so after this fireworks display. And everyone was expecting them to drop it down, just like they do at New Year's Eve in New York with the glass apple. But they didn't drop it down. It was pretty anticlimactic. They just sort of lowered it really slowly, and then the Germans just flattened it. They hopped on it and flattened it. So,
But they're more cautious.
Pardon?
They're more cautious.
The Germans?
Well, they are with that ritual. They didn't drop it.
No, they didn't, no.
They were too cautious.
They lowered it very carefully.
So you're good at percepts. What's your percept from all this 4 months down the way?
Oh, Jesus.
No, give us one.
What do you want a percept on, Germany? No.
Well, what's the deepest one in you? Maybe the one's hardest to talk about.
Okay, well, I just went on a media fast for about 4 months.
Yeah?
I haven't had television, newspapers, radio, nothing. So I slowed down quite a bit from what I was before.
Yeah.
But I took a break from Bob for 4 months.
Yeah.
I needed that bit of health there. So so I don't know what you guys have been talking about. I heard this first bit about Twin Peaks, and I personally never watched the show. So it sounded like Siskel and Ebert show here. Everyone talking about the aspects of Twin Peaks.
Well, you'd be more interested if you knew it was actually a documentary on what we're doing here at CKLN. You can't believe it. It's all about Bob and killing people.
Oh, is it?
Yeah.
Yeah? But you were saying that it's no good anymore.
Oh, no, I think it's good. No, yeah, we didn't finish that point. The caller says it won't last past the second series, but I'm saying that the real sub-geniuses are into it now because it's obvious what it's really about and it's significant. Of course, the Pinks can't stand it. They're not going to watch it, so the ratings go down. This is a good sign. It's going homeopathic, so to speak. But I know some sub-geniuses who can't wait till next Saturday to see what happens next because it's going to confirm what they've heard here on the show. So it's we're excited by it. It's just the Pinks can't take it.
Oh, okay.
And they knew what was coming up, so they put it under the dead spot. But the sub-geniuses like Mike and that, we're taping it, we're studying it, and it's confirming our realities.
Oh, okay. Are you going to make a new Holy Office then?
No. David Lynch is playing Strictly Ketchup. It goes to me. I mean, look at Laura Palmer, her birthday, July 22nd, 1972. That's already a very important date for the Marshall McLuhan and Mae Brussel Holy Office. So no problem. Lynch is not further along the path than me. He's playing Ketchup, and, of course, a lot of people are going to wait for that amazing interview when Bob Marshall interviews David Lynch. That'll be off and awful.
Hey,
awesome.
Hey, Bob, what do you think is going to happen to Cole? And Helmut Kohl, he has to go up for re-election soon.
Yeah, he probably will.
Are you going to give him the okay, or are you going to kick him out?
We're kicking him out because,
that's
you know,
what I would have said, did he kick the guy out?
You see, there's already a heavy consensus in Europe that this United Europe, this Fortress Europe, this reunification has incredible disservices.
Mm-hmm.
So the revolution we saw in 89, the slack of consolidation this year is going to be sped up. We're going to have more excitement and demandings and rebellions against whatever images of dominance are projected. It's going to be turmoil in Europe for the next 8 years, probably. And
okay.
You're going to be looking back and say, Cole was a hero for 15 seconds, you know? And then on to the next guy.
Yeah, Cole just happened to catch the last minute of he's a putz.
Yeah, you got the old leftist gorillas out there running around causing trouble.
They were throwing bombs around and burning cars.
Did you see any?
I didn't catch them. We missed them because there were so many police there, it was unbelievable.
See, you in effect,
I mean, they had an army set up because, see, what they were doing was they were setting up their own little wall there that night with the police. They surrounded us all and kept us pretty quiet. So,
But, well, it's pretty obvious to the world this whole scenario of 1989 was a colossal hoax. The world government can't work. It's obsolete.
Hey, this is... I had to ask you this, though. Okay, who did you use to set up that reunification there? Because there were some signs there that looked kind of suspicious.
You mean what person did I use?
Yeah, what sort of organizations were operating that thing behind the scenes there?
Well, it was...
you had some help from Gorbachev, right? But he was the ones who were operating from East Germany and West Germany.
Yeah, you see, on the Secret Council 10, the three other people I ran against in February 88 were Prince Charles. These are members of the Secret Council 10, all right?
Mm-hmm.
And if you'd heard the Exus reading last 2 weeks ago, mm-hmm. you would have heard the Exus tell us that there are 10 people involved in what I'm talking about, concerned about this new solar government apparatus they're bringing in. They
mm-hmm.
named 10. Now, we know that's the Secret Council of 10, all right?
Okay.
And... On three of the other members are Prince Charles, Prince Turnin-Taxis in Germany,
yes.
and the Romanov gang, not related to the Romanov family of the Tsar at the turn of the century in Russia, but a name that resonates with that. But Romanov is the backer of Gorbachev on the Secret Council 10, all right?
Mm-hmm.
The German action was totally organized by Prince Johannes Turnin-Taxis. And when
mm-hmm.
he met with LaRouche and Helga in 1982...
Mm-hmm.
At one of his 10 castles, he's got many castles, 6 to 10 castles in Europe, he told LaRouche and his wife Helga that if they keep up the kind of information they were putting out, he would do away with them. And there were several assassination attempts on Helga in the September and the fall of 82. They didn't succeed. But anyways, Turnin-Taxis is the guy behind the scenes in Europe right now, and that's why the Arabs are getting nervous, and that's why the United States had to go into the Middle East, and more to come about that later.
Yeah, I saw what was it, field office of Turnin-Taxis down in Munich. He's got, you know, their little banks there, Turnin-Taxis.
Yeah, so is that the guy that you say you saw? Or what do you mean by the signs?
Well, I didn't see him personally, but there's another thing there. They were handing out these pins on the East German side of the gate, right? We were right at the gate there.
Yeah.
And as you walk through the gate, there's a bunch of guys there, and they have these big, sort of like those recycling boxes that we have around Toronto, right?
Yeah.
They had these big boxes full of pins, and there was no indication of who had printed these pins, and all it said was, you can talk with me. But the symbol on it looked suspiciously like the old eye in the pyramid, sort of a logo, stylized logo with the old eye in the pyramid from the, you know, the Priory de Sion and all that.
Yeah, the Priory of Sion, the Illuminati symbol that Wilson makes a lot of, Robert Anton Wilson.
So I'm wondering if, like, that was a ploy to make people think, okay, this is the old... the Illuminati group running it, or to shift attention away from the Secret Council of Ten, right?
Yeah, well, the Secret Council...
set up a fall guy.
That's accurate analysis. See, the solar government runs this whole scene, and world government's obsolete, so the solar government will wake up the fear of the world government at the same time the inevitability of it,
mm-hmm.
all right, to create this distraction and red herring from the real action operated by tetradic structures out of management on the Secret Council of Ten, the solar theater level. Right,
mm-hmm.
So you're right. They're gonna wake up and make it obviously the old world government archetype, the old
mm-hmm.
Archetypal images of the Illuminati. They're gonna make that obvious to people.
Yeah.
And
that's what that book, The Messianic Legacy, was about.
Yeah.
They were
yeah.
trying to wake up that the United Europe concept was hatched with the world government and not the solar government.
Right, and so we're going to go through so many changes. As the X's say, the definition of the second coming is perpetual change, and this is entirely possible under the electric effect of fire, or the
mm-hmm.
fire effect of electricity, that by 1992 we'll have exhausted this whole United Europe world government scenario.
Mm-hmm.
And then we'll get really close to Bob Rule at that point,
mm-hmm.
which is just exposing the fact that I rule already through the solar government, and then we move into universal government propaganda, and then we move into mythic government, which are, that's from 1990 to 2020. Now, I spelled out that 2 weeks ago, and you missed that, but
mm-hmm.
check the archives, you can understand that.
Yeah.
So mythic government is what we're in now, and I have to go through these layers, peel them away to show what's happening under mythic government, what it is.
Yeah. You know, here's an interesting footnote to that, the European unity concept. They're going to have, since they're throwing down all the borders in Europe, right? they're all dealing with this problem of what are they going to do with Holland because of they've got legalized drugs there, right?
Yeah.
So what happens when you open up the borders and there's no custom guards anymore? With the countries where it is illegal, right, they can't just ignore it. So that's a serious problem for them because they don't know what to do about it. So I would say that's that might be dealing with the concept of the inner self, right? The inner world, trying to deal with it on a world government level.
Yeah.
See what I'm saying?
Yeah. The management of inner space.
Yeah. They have to deal with that. And if you go to Amsterdam, everything's do your own thing and do whatever it is and don't worry about the governments and
stuff.
Well,
that's part of the universal government structure because the universe is the inner dimensions as well as the outer dimensions, right?
Mm-hmm.
It goes further than the solar government structure. So, yeah, that's a universal government concern to deal with inner space. But all previous structures and governments try to deal with it.
But if you're going to lay on that to some world government propaganda, then they'll probably have to make drugs illegal then in Holland as well.
Well,
rather than let it go.
And what?
Rather than let it go and let it spread through Europe because they're not ready for that quite yet.
Well, as we have more electric technologies to play with, we don't need drugs as much. We're finding the electric environment quite addictive. So
yeah.
The world government can use that as agenda, stamp out drugs as an obsolete program.
They're going to have to start working on stamp out video games.
That's solar government work.
Yeah.
And then the universal government work is maybe what Lynch is getting at, dealing with the psychic and how to rule the psychic.
So you know what's going to happen then with the solar government. Okay, the world government's stamping out drugs, the war on drugs, but the solar government's going to have a war on electronics,
pink version of media ecology.
Yeah, because they're going to have the thing that they're going to declare video games